Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. What makes something racist or sexist? And why do white Americans seem to be divided along red and blue lines? Betsy Leonderwright is a sociologist long focused on class and on racial and economic inequality. She was an associate professor at LaSalle University. She's also taught at Harvard, Tufts, and Boston College. Betsy Leonderwright is co-author with Jesse Strybe of Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Why Red and Blue White People Disagree and How to Decide in the Gray Areas. Betsy, welcome.
Thanks, Mindy. I'm delighted to be with you this morning.
So most people you talked with about the book say that they've argued with relatives or coworkers, usually around racism. What's behind these arguments?
Yeah, I think we've all got, you know, Uncle Bob, and do we think the joke he said at Thanksgiving was racist or not? But it's also gender, like, oh, somebody's making a Me Too claim at my workplace. Is it valid or not? It's really surprising how often in life we need to weigh in on something is or isn't racist. And we're sharply divided. And we now have evidence that white Americans in particular are just coming from extremely different viewpoints in answering these questions. What we discovered is that the definitions being used on, say, the more liberal side and more conservative side, the definitions of what is racism and what is sexism are dramatically different. So we're talking apples and oranges, not the same thing. And the methods of approaching those questions are also very different. So we end up really almost unable to have coherent conversations about these tricky topics.
While conservatives maintain that they and their candidate are not racist and sexist, many liberals argue it was those biases that helped Donald Trump win the election. How do you make sense of those conflicting claims?
Yeah, that's definitely one of the interpretations for Trump's very strong white support, is that when he puts forward racist and sexist things, that the voters like that. I think that's a vast oversimplification. Trump voters are very, very diverse ideologically as well as in other ways. And they don't all think about racism and sexism in the same ways. About half of the 120 something people we interviewed were identified as conservative or Republican, and most of those voted for Trump or plan to again. And we found actually that most of them, that was not Trump's biggest appeal. So you can argue that by excusing xenophobic statements against immigrants or excusing harassment of women, that you're buying into it. But I think it's a false leap to say, oh, the racial resentment is the biggest motivating factor. That's been studied quite a lot, not just by me and Jesse Strybe. And racial resentment has always been part, a subset of the Republican electorate, but not the majority, not everybody, and no more with Trump than with any other Republican candidate.
Interesting. In the book, you note that from the 1980s through the early 2000s, most white people held stable views regarding what they considered racist and sexist. Since then, however, many have begun to change their minds. So describe this shift and why it began.
This is some of why we decided to just interview white people, is that with other racial and ethnic groups, the proportions thinking in different, in the same, you know, and having different opinions on race or gender issues has stayed fairly stable. In recent decades, a white opinion has polarized. So the Republican Party, and especially the far right of it, has taken up the denial of racism as a major issue, threatening to cut back on affirmative action and banning DEI, which we just saw by President Trump last night, diversity, equity, inclusion program. Sorry, I'm speaking.
Yeah.
And at the same time, liberals really took up causes of the Black Lives Matter and Me Too movements, being opposed to racism and sexism became a platform of the Democratic Party in a way that it hadn't been in many decades, and became a liberal, more central liberal causes. And that the primarily was white people who went to those very strongly conflicting ideological opposite points of view.
The book illuminates white Americans' judgment calls, those decisions they render about what they believe is racist and sexist and what isn't. And many argue that institutional isms inflict far more damage than individual actions do. So, what are white Americans using to base these judgments? And should anyone but the person being impacted have an opinion?
Well, I think we all should have an opinion because these are major problems with our society. So I'm in the my definition for myself includes institutionalized racism, that the outcomes, it like housing and real estate prices are very, very different depending on your race, the health care you receive, whether you're likely to be insured or uninsured, whether you're likely to have a toxic facility poisoning you near where you live. So many things, as well as criminal justice, which is the one we've all become so familiar with. We do have these big cleavages where outcomes are just worse, whether it's health, income, wealth, for African American, Latino immigrant, and Native American people. But that is not part of the definition. The people who mostly say no, things are not racist, things are not sexist, those institutional disparities are not part of their definitions. That was really interesting to learn. So about half the people that we interviewed, we asked them dozens of questions with fictional scenarios, scenarios in the news, in their lives. Is this racist? Is this sexist? The people who said no, to just about every question, their definition of racism and of sexism are those are very narrow definitions. It has to be intentional. It has to ha harm an individual in a way that the majority group or non-targeted group never is harmed. It's like race or gender needs to be mentioned explicitly for a comment to be racist or sexist. So they've defined it so narrowly that that very few things clear that bar. So I think everybody we talk to, with one creepy exception, everybody we talk to is opposed to hate crimes and violent, threats and hate speech. So there are types of racism and sexism that we're united on being almost entirely united on being opposed to. But the broader definition, the people who said, yes, that's racist, that's sexist, over and over said, yes. Their definition is very broad, and I share that definition, that the institutional disparities that no one intends, intent is not the point. You can be biased unintentionally, you can have unconscious stereotypes in your mind, that's racism and sexism. And if we're setting up our institutions in ways that some people get better health care than others, or some people get better housing and property appreciation than others, some people get better K-12 education than others, just in a way that's disproportionate by race, by that broader definition, that is racism and that is sexism.
And it's interesting you're talking about, the different definitions people have. And there were some that didn't really have a working definition, never really deeply thought about it, right? So it seems impossible to make progress without a common understanding. So as a starting point, how do we define each of these terms?
Right. Yeah, I think having some conversations, if you find yourself disagreeing, as we all do, with someone, having that going explicit and talking about, well, how do you define racism? How do you define sexism? Is a good question. And of course, if you want to find common ground and have a constructive conversation and have a hope of as I used to with my students, broadening someone's definition, starting with listening and what, how did they see it is a really good way to start. Yeah, I think I'd like to see some, a lot of people have broader definitions than they have now. For example, we show a we showed a cartoon to the interviewees of a and read them a little story about a white police officer shoots an unarmed black man who was holding a cell phone up in his hand, and asked and the white officer says to a supervisor, I would have shot him if he was white too. We asked people, is there racism in that situation? Do you see racism? And so the people who tended to always say no, they asked a lot of questions, like had a crime just been committed? What did the officer have a history of shooting people of color? And they before they formed their judgment, they asked a lot of questions. Which I think is a good practice, actually. And then they said, well, you got to give somebody the benefit of the doubt. It's innocent until proven guilty. And so they would say, I'm not sure, but I think probably no, that it wasn't being racist. Whereas the more liberal people who tended to say yes, yes, and yes to all our questions, they quickly, without asking any questions about the story, said yes, it's racist, because they know the national pattern that black people and other people of color who are unarmed are shot by police much at a much higher rate than white people. So they know the pattern, and so they would jump to immediately saying yes. So that was a little disconcerting to me, because I think that's not asking questions is not a great habit.
While you hope that your research will be of value to people regardless of their politics, you and your co-author reveal yourselves as liberals from the outset. How do you encourage conservatives to put your affiliation aside to consider your findings?
Well, I think conservative readers of the book has just been out exactly 1 week today, so I don't think many people have read it yet. I think conservative readers are going to feel very heartened by how even-handed we are, that we do see some positive things in their approach to the question. Even though I think their definitions may be too narrow, the habit of asking questions as if you were an investigator in a criminal case is a good one, and they're not always wrong. And the fact that we do find some flaws in the liberal approaches, I think some people who consider themselves like anti-woke are going to be like, see, I knew it. Because sometimes people who really sincerely want to reduce racism and sexism do jump to conclusions in an unhelpful way, that in any given case, you really need to look into the details of the case if you're going to make things better, which is, that's the point of the book, is like, let's make things fairer.
We're talking with Betsy Leander Wright. She's the co-author of Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Why Red and Blue White People Disagree and How to Decide in the Gray Areas. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Betsy Leander Wright. She's a sociologist focused on class and on racial and economic inequality. She, along with Jesse Strieb, are the authors of Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Why Red and Blue White People Disagree and How to Decide in the Gray Areas. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. The racism and sexism prevalent today are considerably more subtle and, you argue, more unintentional than those of, for instance, the 1950s. What do those changes demand of us if we are to identify and dismantle the inequalities?
Yeah, great question. As I said earlier, the most people deplore outright violent hate crimes, hate speech against people of color, against women, and that's good. That's a good basis. But those things have dropped. The hate crime levels have dropped in recent decades. They still exist, of course, but I think that the people who used such narrow definitions that we interviewed are a little behind the times, because in my opinion, and based on research, outright discrimination, like I'm not going to hire a woman for this job, or I'm only going to promote white people, it still exists, but it's less common. And yet the disparities in income and wealth and health outcomes, life expectancy, the disparities by both race and gender persist. And so I think it's imperative to widen our definition of, if we want to get to a society of equal opportunity, which is very widely held value, we're going to have to dismantle some of those institutional barriers. So that, to me, I hope that this book and other education on I'm thinking right now of race disparities, I hope this will open some people's eyes to how it's actually helpful to have a definition of racism and sexism that includes structural barriers, and then needs to change how our institutions work. Of course, our country just last night took a dramatic turn in the other direction when newly sworn President Trump signed an executive order eliminating diversity, equity, and inclusion programs from all federal agencies. He's instructed certain offices to take those down. And that's a lot where people who aren't, college students or something, that's some of where people learn about the persistence of race and gender inequality.
Yeah, I think there are so many people that would agree about there needs to be institutional change. But boy, oh boy, is that hard to accomplish, right?
It is, but it's been done. We celebrated Martin Luther King Day yesterday. We had outright legal segregation in the Jim Crow South for many, many decades, and people banded together collectively and waged campaigns piece by piece. If they'd said, let's bring down all of Jim Crow, that would have felt too big and too discouraging. But they picked, the Montgomery bus boycott, they picked one segregated bus line, they picked one segregated lunch counter at a time, and put on pressure. And we can do that too. If
Sociological theories suggest that people make decisions based on the demographic groups that they belong to, but you found that white views on what constitutes racism and sexism don't follow those rules. So what do you believe those theories are missing? What was it based on?
This is sometimes called standpoint theory, that your own social identities, where you stand in an unequal society, really influences what you see in the society. And there's a lot of good in standpoint theory, but if that were true, we would have found our female and male interviewees, which is about half and half, would have had dramatically different views on sexism and the prevalence, the continued prevalence of sexism. And we didn't. We found that the women that saw no racism in our society also, by and large, most of them also saw no sexism, even if they'd been personally affected by sexual harassment or pay inequities or something. They're like, no, it happens to men too. And so that was a real clue. And the men who saw a lot of racism also saw a lot of sexism. So it, excuse me, it broke down a lot more by ideology, the red and the blue, than by your own demographics. And so this is a hopeful thing. Excuse me, I've got a frog in my throat. This is a hopeful thing about white people. That I'm white myself. The fact that we aren't personally affected by racism doesn't mean we can't see it, and doesn't mean we can't work against it. That the sources of our beliefs are not just from who we are. We also hypothesized that there would be a class difference in how people defined racism and sexism, and there
That's
wasn't.
awesome. Wow. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your research. 127 white voting adults aged 39 to 50, 35 to 59, split evenly along political, gender, regional, and class lines. Two basic camps formed, which you labeled acquitters and convictors. So tell us a little bit about that. Introduce us to these two groups.
So we decided to use a courtroom metaphor. And we all might be called onto a jury. We all can picture ourselves in a jury. And that metaphor is the fact that we all have to make judgment calls about whether things are racist or sexist all the time, much more than we're probably aware of, whether that's online, celebrity comments, our relatives' comments, things that happen in our workplace or our school. So we positioned our interviewees as if they were the jury in a criminal courtroom, and that they have to make these judgment calls. And so, as I said earlier, about half of everyone tended to say no to almost every question. We showed them vignette after vignette, story from the news after story from the news. We asked them about things they'd seen in their lives, and they tended to say no in the vast majority of cases, unless something was an explicit hate crime. So we call them the acquitters because in their imagined jury box, they vote to acquit. And then about half of everybody on both racism and sexism tended to say, yes, such and such a situation, I see racism there. This other situation, I see sexism there. And so we call them convictors. They vote to acquit, to convict. And the interesting thing was not just that they have different definitions, as I've said, but that the way they approach the questions is different. And I think this is some of where the confusion between red and blue Americans comes in. Is that we our mental processes when we are faced with this question of need to make a judgment call, our way of doing it is different.
Yeah, as a convictors, you say, prefer what you call algorithmic thinking, while the
Algorithmic,
acquitters, yeah, investigative methods.
So and both are useful to some extent. We see good in both. So the convictors who usually say yes, they are taking the particular case and doing like an algorithm would. They're looking to match it with a pattern. So they're much more aware of patterns of inequity. And so they think, well, this case matches that pattern, and so I'm going to say yes. So, for example, the police officer shooting the unarmed a white police officer shooting the unarmed black guy in the fictional vignette, they say they know that that happens more, and so they say yes. And it was discouraging to me as a liberal who shares a lot of their definitions. They usually said yes without asking a single question. They just like jumped to the conclusion. I was like, oops, I don't think that's the greatest. But knowing the algorithms, knowing the patterns is very, very valuable for spotting racism or sexism. The acquitters, the ones who usually said no, things weren't racist or sexist, they put themselves in the role of being like a criminal investigator. So innocent until proven guilty, they would ask a lot of questions, and the questions would lead them off until their preferred outcome. That no, they're coming up with alternative theories and giving the benefit of the doubt to the accused. So they and the asking questions I think is good, but they think they disregard the broader pattern. They disregard whether this kind of thing has ever happened. A lot of them simply didn't know about the disparities. But so here's one that I really love that shows the difference so clearly. We showed a cartoon of a guy lying in a hospital bed, and a woman in a white coat walks in the door, and he says, "Hello, nurse." And she frowns and says, "I'm your doctor." And so is that sexist? So the convictors just said, "Yes, it is." And some of them had stories from workplaces of because that is a common thing that women in high professional positions, especially in medicine, they are presumed to be at the lower level or to be in a traditionally female occupation. So the pattern is real. And so they said, yes, it's sexist. The acquitters, they asked such amazing array of questions. What was the angle of his hospital bed to the door? Was he on any meds that might have impacted his cognition? And they wanted to give him, he's a sick guy. You don't want to go, where they were sympathetic with him of the idea of him being called sexist. They asked enough questions so that their preferred outcome of no, he's not being sexist was perfectly assured.
Yeah, so interesting. Let's talk to Mark, who's giving us a call from Yarmouth. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good morning, ladies. How are you?
Good.
Good morning,
Good.
Mark.
I just wanted to call. Pardon me?
Go
I
ahead,
said,
Mark.
good morning, Mark.
Yeah.
I just wanted to call and comment on some of the comments and statistics you made when it came to regarding police officers' interactions with black suspects. All your information is incorrect. Black people are shot. Unarmed black people are shot, and unarmed black people are shot at a much lower rate than white people are, according to the statistics from the DOJ and the FBI. I've got some stats from 2019. This is something I've kind of kept track of. I was in the military, and I was in the military police as a reservist.
And Mark, you say your statistics are from 2019. Is that what you just said?
Yeah, these particular ones are. And they tend to be pretty relevant right down the line.
Right. Let Betsy respond to that. Go ahead, Betsy.
Yeah, we fact-checked that one very intensively because because it was so hot in the news at the time we were doing the interviews, and so many of our interviewees said the same things that you did. There's a couple things going on. Obviously, you need to look not at the raw numbers, because white people are two-thirds of the entire population, but you need to look at proportions in relation that African Americans are only 13% of the population. So, there are a lot of white people shot by police. By and large, they're much more likely to be armed and dangerous, because in part because of over-policing of predominantly African American neighborhoods. The police are mostly only called on white people if something pretty serious is going down. Some of them I think are also unjust, but the raw numbers of white people shot are greater because they're greater number in the a greater portion of the population, and because they're mostly only engaged with the police once there's a serious crime underway. So unarmed black people are shot way disproportionately to their number, to their percentage of the population.
Mark, thank you. Thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking with Betsy Leander Wright. She's a co-author of Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Why Red and Blue White People Disagree and How to Decide in the Gray Areas. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to, excuse me, you're listening to The Point. We're talking with Betsy Leander Wright. She is the co-author with Jesse Strybe of Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Why Red and Blue White People Disagree and How to Decide in the Gray Areas. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Mark is still here from Yarmouth. He wanted to respond to your answer, Betsy. Mark, go for it.
Hey. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call again.
Yeah, sure.
As again, as I was going through, some of the stats, while I understand that there's a proportionality to the, white population and black population, the vast majority of this, I think, is driven by the media in a false narrative that, police officers are just out there killing black people. That just isn't the case. Mm-hmm. In 2019, there were only 9 unarmed black people shot by police. Another stat is that, you know, police are 18 times more likely to be shot by a black male. And while black people only make up 13% of the population, they commit over 50% of the violent crimes. So I think it's just a, it does a disservice to the police officers and to the black community to put that information out there that just isn't correct. And as far as over policing goes, you know, the more police officers there are in black neighborhoods, black communities, the safer those communities are.
All right. Mark, thank you for sharing your thoughts. We appreciate that. Betsy, do you want to say anything before we move on?
Yeah, as I said, we really fact checked that in great detail. I'll direct you within the book to the footnotes on pages 83, 84, and 85. We have data from the National Institute on Drug Abuse and from about the Office of Police Policy Development and Research, and about four researchers who've looked into the situation. So I think some of your facts are incorrect.
You found differences among acquitters and convictors according to their intensity of their partisanship. How do the motivated and moderate members of each group go about making their judgment calls?
Yeah, that was actually very inspiring to me and gave me hope, because we all know the red-blue divide is virulent now. It's where there's actual hostile camps, including on these issues in our society, and we saw that come out in this recent election. But most Americans are not super ideological, not super partisan. As we know, most people don't vote who can, and the majority of our interviewees did not seem to have that that strong motivation to come up with a particular answer. That this is called motivated reasoning, where you have a worldview, and so you jump on facts that likely to support the views that you already have. That's true for all of us. That's just a human trait. But it's truer for people who have a strong sense of a political tribe. So the motivated convictors and acquitters, they read partisan or watched partisan news sources. Some of them belong to the Democratic or Republican Party. And so they the answers they gave, yes, there's racism, or no, there's not, or sexism, were the answers that would make them fit more in their political tribe. But we also found these categories we call moderate, who were more nuanced, who said the other answer more often. And I found both of them, these groups, very, very interesting. The moderate acquitters who said they don't see racism, they don't see sexism, but I think especially racism, the majority of them were proud to be colorblind. And so their definition is, if race isn't mentioned, then that's better. But also, if race isn't mentioned, there's no racism. One of the most startling things, I ended up sympathizing with all these people that in some ways I disagree with. I ended up respecting them a lot and where they were coming from, even if we disagreed. And it was surprising numbers of the proudly colorblind people who, I don't see race, I don't see gender, I treat everybody the same, and therefore I don't see racism or sexism. A lot of them were raised by bigots. They grew up, you know, their grandfather used the N-word, or their sister was told by their parents that she couldn't date a person of color. They were determined to be different than their bigoted relatives. And so they were proud of themselves. And yet that stance of I don't see color, I don't see gender, led them to say no, they don't see racism or sexism in most situations. So I disagree with their conclusions, but I admire their determination to be different.
Although their definitions and approach leave them seeing little racism against people of color, little sexism against women, some of these motivated acquitters through this project who call out and stand up against the limited amount of racism and sexism that they do acknowledge. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'll tell one story that really did blow my mind open. Because I sort of thought that white people line up on like trying to be anti-racist, effectively anti-racist, then colorblind, and then buying into and perpetuating racism. So we interviewed a longtime diner waitress in the South that we call Alice, and she put out every single like MAGA talking point of like Black Lives Matter is racist because it doesn't allow white people to join, which of course is not true. She had all this misinformation and this really indignant thing that she thought racism against white people was the worst kind. So I thought, motivated a quitter. And when we got her life story, she when she was a younger woman, her Black best friend was imprisoned, went to jail for a long time. And she took in her daughter as a foster daughter. She took her and she raised her until she was 17 while her mother was in jail. And when Alice's mother, her white mother, said, "I'm not coming in your house as long as that N-word girl is there," she chose her foster daughter over her own mother. She cut her mother off. So I find that admirable. And I think a lot of liberals who pride themselves on being anti-racist have never sacrificed that much. She stood up against her mother's racism to take care of this African American girl. So she kind of messed up my inner assumption. And I probably did have some stereotypes about Southerners and, low income white Southerners. And we found a lot of those that when something does cross their line of this very narrow definition of racism or sexism, lots of the acquitters, including the motivated acquitters, they stood up against it. They pushed back. It gave them hope.
It kind of goes back to something you were saying earlier is in these conversations is listening, right? We have these stereotypes and misunderstandings. And when you listen to somebody's point of view, why they feel the way they do, or their stories, you learn a lot about where some of their decisions are coming from, right? It might not be what you think.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about being a sociologist is like you get to just listen to people that you otherwise might not have talked to. It's a really exhilarating process. And for the goal, our goal in the book is to reduce unjust inequalities in our society. And if you write off everybody who voted a different way than you, or everybody that has a different definition of racism or sexism than you, if you just say they're just hopeless, they're the plastic basket of deplorables, you're missing a lot of potential allies. I think dialogue is really important, listening, noticing that there are actually positive aspects to other people's methods of approaching situations.
Let's talk to William, who's calling from Wellfleet. Hi, William.
Hi. I tuned into your show a little late, but the topic is very, very relevant and meaningful to me for the simple reason that I've witnessed and I've had encounters with police and I've witnessed courts and jails and things like that. I got plenty of war stories. Anyway, the purpose of the call is I just picked up a book. I ran across it accidentally in a thrift shop here in Mass on Cape. And the title is The New Jim Crow, subtitled
Yes.
Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness by Michelle Alexander. I just started reading it, and it is one painful read, let me tell you. However, it is well-researched, well-written, and very relevant to this topic you're discussing today, and
yeah,
well, I'm recommending it.
William, I can say Betsy's nodding her head. She knows the book. William, thank you for the call. Betsy, you read it?
Yeah, in college courses on race and ethnicity, I assigned that New Jim Crow book, and it really is devastating about how racial bias permeates our criminal justice system. So from the beginning of what we were talking about with the other caller earlier, how much police presence is there, on what bases are people arrested, but also about severity of charges, severity of sentencing, treatment about parole, treatment after release from prison. From soup to nuts, it's a dramatically different experience to be white and involved in the criminal justice system, and to be specifically, she's focused on African Americans.
Cynthia is calling from Barnstable. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, Mindy. I just have a comment. Your guest today, I felt dismissed your caller, Mark, in saying he had statistics that she didn't agree with. And instead of saying, pointing out the fact that those statistics came from two different places. So his stats came from one source and hers from another.
Right.
And instead of just pointing that out, she stated that he was incorrect. His statements were false or incorrect. I'm not sure exactly the word she used.
Right.
And I see that as a case in point as to why there is this great divide that continues. Because whenever someone from one viewpoint disagrees with the other, they are just considered wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to point that out.
Cynthia, thanks. Let's let Betsy respond to that. Go ahead, Betsy.
Yeah, thanks for that, Cynthia. I think you are right that the kind of constructive dialogue that we need to have in this country, of talking across the red-blue divide, I think I know some of what works well there, and you're right, that didn't happen in the conversation between me and Mark. I agree with you on the getting down to values and what matters to us, not just arguing about facts, but what do you care about? What kind of country do you want to live in? I think that's where we will find the common ground, is in our values.
Let me ask you this. Similar to media fact-checking websites popular in recent years, you include, as you mentioned, your background facts throughout the book meant to help settle common disputes over statistics. Yet it seems unlikely that both acquitters and convictors would acknowledge the sources that you cite. So how do we come to agree on which facts are accurate and which are not?
Yeah, it's tricky. We have this widespread mistrust of each other's media outlets in this polarized society. And there have to be some neutral parties that we can agree do that extensive fact checking. I really trust the website PolitiFact because they'll criticize anybody who makes a misstatement. They do politicians, they do things that are spread around the media, also factcheck.org. I think, you know, the truth exists. So we do need to dig, and not we all have a tendency to just take for granted what our favorite media outlets say. And we've got to let that go and do some digging, which we did. We deliberately, the footnotes of our references are at the back of the book, because who needs to look at those? They're boring. But we really, really worked on the fact checking. We're looking into multiple sources, and then we put those, anything that might be a controversial statement, and we disagree with both our acquitters and our convictors. We disagree with both sides, but also sometimes agree. And we put those fact checks at the bottom of the page so that you can check them yourself.
All right, so as this project unfolded, you found yourself questioning your own methods for making judgment calls. To create recommendations for the best approach, you borrowed from your respondents, keeping elements of acquitters and convictors approaches that worked best, tossing those that did not serve the goal of reducing unfair inequalities out. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we came up with a different metaphor, not in the courtroom anymore. We call it the surveyor method. It's the role that that land surveyors use during a construction project. So there's three parts to it. One is you need to know the landscape. You need to know the underlying geology of what's happening in the land, even the parts you can't see. And so that's learning about the patterns of disparities of race and gender that you see. That you might not see with your own experience. Then the second part of the surveyor method is to probe the specific construction site, to ask a lot of questions, as the acquitters do, about the specific case. Don't make assumptions. Just because you know what the pattern is in the wider landscape, don't make assumptions about the specific case, but really dig into it, talk to people, gather facts. And then the third thing is to work together with others to collaborate to build a strong building. So that's the metaphor for making our institutions and our interactions be fairer in the future. So to dig out those race and gender disparities, to make processes in our schools, our workplaces, our politics go better. And when you do all those three things, you will not fall into the pitfalls that either acquitters or convictors fall into, and you will be a force for making things fairer.
Also, you talk about humility. You say humility plays a vital role as we strive to make better judgment calls. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, especially our motivated interviewees, they were just so sure they were right. And sometimes they were, and sometimes it's verifiable that they weren't. So going into situations where there's a risk or an accusation of racism or sexism, going into the details of the situation, talking to people, and listening. I think listening is really key. And I really did change through doing these interviews. I really thought I was going to just love the way that the more liberal convictors approach things because I do share their broader definition. And I realized we all have flaws in our reasoning. We all can get better at this. And it really behooves us. I'm speaking as a white person. I think white people need to take some special responsibility for eliminating racism, just as men need to take some special responsibility for reducing sexism.
Betsy Leonda Wright, co-author with Jesse Strybe of The Color of Wealth is your past book. This one, is it racist? Is it sexist? Why red and blue white people disagree and how to decide in the gray areas. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Betsy, thanks for being here today. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's so my pleasure, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.